From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we meet John Lee Anderson, a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. He writes a regular column called Letters from Baghdad. His work took him to the streets of the city, into prisons, and through war-torn towns in the countryside. Anderson's experiences in war and its aftermath and his conversations with Iraqis are the basis of his new book, The Fall of Baghdad. Also, the life of a New York bounty hunter. We meet Tom Evangelista, whose family bail bond business is the subject of a new HBO reality series called Family Bonds. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush addressed the UN General Assembly today in New York, defending his decision to go to war in Iraq. He said that Iraq is moving toward democracy, adding that it's the responsibility of every nation to help Iraq's interim government.
The UN and its member nations must respond to Prime Minister Alawi's request and do more to help build an Iraq that is secure, democratic, federal, and free.
UN Secretary General Kofi Annan addressed the General Assembly just before Mr. Bush, saying the international rule of law is at risk because of the instability in Iraq. Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry says Iraq is in crisis and that President Bush lacks the credibility to win more international help. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
President Bush's appeal to the United Nations for more support in Iraq is consistent with Senator Kerry's own recommendations. But Kerry says the president missed an opportunity because he lectured to other countries instead of leading them to help in Iraq.
Not one country has yet stepped up and put one troop on the ground to help protect the UN electorate, and the president hasn't led to get them to do so. This is his job. He's the president today, and Iraq is becoming more and more of a mess every single day.
Kerry also says while the world is better off without Saddam Hussein in power, that does not justify the Iraq war. He repeated his claim that the president's handling of Iraq has made America less safe. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Jacksonville, Florida.
A group linked to al-Qaeda claims it has murdered the second of two American hostages in Iraq. The group, led by Jordanian Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, said it killed Jack Hensley, an American civil engineer, because the U.S. did not meet a deadline to release Muslim women from prison in Iraq. The claim has not yet been verified. The kidnappers are now threatening to kill a British hostage. The death toll continues to rise in northern Haiti, where more than 600 people have died in the aftermath of Tropical Storm Jean. Amelia Shaw has more from Port-au-Prince.
Residents and aid workers in northern Haiti continue to struggle against floods that have destroyed Haiti's third-largest city, Gonaïves. The United Nations estimates that 80,000 people are without access to clean water, food, or shelter. Medical teams arrived in the area on Sunday, but flooded roads have cut them off from many areas. A military spokesman for the UN says UN personnel are unable to provide necessary humanitarian assistance and warned of impending epidemics. As the floodwaters recede, the UN expects the death toll to rise even further. So far, most of the casualties have been children. For NPR News, I'm Amelia Shaw in Port-au-Prince.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 40 points to close at 10,245. The Nasdaq was up 13 to 1921. This is NPR News. The Senate Intelligence Committee has approved the nomination of Florida Congressman Porter Goss to be the new head of the CIA. All the Republicans on the panel voted to recommend Goss, and they were joined by three of the committee's eight Democrats. Democrats had expressed concern about Goss's history of partisanship during his years in Congress and questioned whether he could be independent in his judgments. The full Senate is expected to confirm Goss later this week. A man suspected of shooting and killing an unarmed guard inside the Illinois state capitol has been charged with first-degree murder. NPR's Cheryl Corley has more.
Authorities arrested Derek Potts without incident in the morning after receiving a phone call about a man matching the description of the Capitol shooter who was knocking on doors in a residential neighborhood of Springfield, Illinois, and asking for a ride to the police station. Potts was unarmed, but police believe he is the man who allegedly marched into the Illinois State Capitol yesterday afternoon and fatally shot 51-year-old William Wozniak in the chest. The Capitol does not have metal detectors and guards are unarmed, but security changes are now in the works. The governor of Illinois, Rod Blagojevich, says he's issuing an executive order to install metal detectors, and other measures are being considered, including the arming of guards. Cheryl Corley, NPR News.
A federal judge in New York has granted Martha Stewart's request to begin serving her 5-month prison sentence for lying about a stock transaction. The judge ordered Stewart to turn herself in on October 8th, and she recommended that federal prison officials assign Stewart to a prison camp in Connecticut or Florida. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from SSRI, featuring Otmar Liebert's new CD, La Semana, exploring nouveau flamenco for the 21st century. Available at Borders.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Writer John Lee Anderson has covered armed conflict in some of the most remote regions of the world. He was among the first Western journalists in Afghanistan after the September 11th attacks, and he's written about guerrilla leaders in Burma and the Western Sahara. For the past 2 years, Anderson's dispatches from Iraq have given readers of the New Yorker magazine compelling pictures of war and its aftermath, from looters making off with a fire truck to intimate conversations with the man known as Saddam Hussein's doctor. Anderson was in Iraq during the buildup to war and remained there throughout the invasion. He's returned several times to cover the post-war reconstruction and insurgency. His new book, The Fall of Baghdad, looks at the Iraq experience in part through the eyes of Iraqis he came to know. I spoke with John Lee Anderson yesterday and asked what his driver, a man named Sabah, experienced in the early stages of the war.
Sabah, like virtually every Iraqi I knew, was directly affected in just those 3 weeks of bombardment of Baghdad. Almost everyone I knew had a member of the family killed. One of Sabah's daughters lost a child, had an involuntary abortion during a particularly intense bombardment of Baghdad one night. She survived but lost the child. One of Sabah's nephews was found dead by the roadside, having apparently bled to death for 2 days. No one helped him in those final days when very few people ventured out on the street and the bombing was intense. By the end of the war, Sabah had, as I say, lost a nephew, an unborn grandson, his daughter had lost the child, and in the aftermath of the city, as the chaos began to gather in Iraq, his life closed down considerably. His son, Allah, who was 11, was kidnapped for several days until he paid a ransom, sold a car to pay the ransom. That was late last year. And like most Iraqis, like most people in Baghdad, life had become extremely insecure, and the hopes he had of a new life, a beginning, were almost completely crushed.
Now, this man, Sabah, was someone who was cooperative with a Westerner before the war, who hated the Saddam Hussein regime, and had you know, some real tragedy and difficulty as a result of the war and its chaotic aftermath. How does he now regard the American invasion and occupation?
Well, Sabah's feelings were all over the place, even during the initial war. I'm speaking of the one that lasted a short time and led to the downfall of Saddam. He swung between a desire to see Saddam go quickly and feelings of anguish and anger over the casualties being caused by the American bombings. So by the end of the war, I'm speaking of April, May 2003, he was, like most Iraqis, just awash in conflicting emotions, but hoping for things to be set right. And a huge sense of disillusionment entered very soon when the looting of the city began and continued and led on into the insurgency. Sabah really, in a sense, is a kind of casualty of the post-war. He He was a driver. That's what he did. He was my man Friday. We became very close during the war. But within 2 months of the fall of Baghdad, he was showing himself incapable of dealing with the rapid changes, the tremendous insecurity that came with the fall of Baghdad and the new era of guerrilla violence and the targeting of Westerners in particular. And he was no longer capable of protecting me. And in one incident in the summer of 2003, he got us caught in a firefight in an urban street in Baghdad. And after that, I realized I had to switch people. I had to have someone who was quick-witted and who smelt danger. Sabah was a man of the Ancien regime. He understood the dangers, the abstract dangers of the Saddam tyranny, but not of the new era. And thereafter, I began moving around with someone else.
It struck me that in a lot of your conversations with educated Iraqis, many of them before the war said the Americans should not think that they're going to be able to occupy this country. We have a history of driving away foreigners. And yet afterward, when the chaos began to spread, many of them said to you, why don't the Americans seize control and establish order? For people like Sabah and many others who found their lives almost unlivable because of the lawlessness in the land, did they want the Americans to go away and leave Iraqis to their own devices, or did they want the Americans to crack down and punish the lawbreakers?
They wanted both things. On the one hand, I think all Iraqis were understandably humiliated by the specter of foreign occupation. They went from being oppressed by Saddam and living cravenly under his rule, informing on one another, never speaking their mind, living in terror that another wave of bloodletting would occur as Saddam had unleashed so many times over the years, watching their step. But essentially, most of them had learned to live. He was the beast they knew. Suddenly, they were faced with roadblocks manned by 18 and 19-year-old American boys with guns who didn't speak their language, didn't know their city, and behaved in a kind of rainbow coalition of ways. You never knew what you were going to get. Some would be out of their heads, cursing and screaming and sometimes shooting people at the roadblocks, and other times you'd get the quintessential polite young American soldier boy. And it was clear very early that they didn't know the terrain they were standing on, which in turn, I think, gave heart to the guerrillas, the insurgents, who very quickly began moving against them as they saw that the Americans were only skeetering on the very surface of their society and didn't know what lay beneath.
One of the people that you talked to, I guess Dr. Waleed, gave you an interesting insight into how American soldiers' activities in Fallujah probably inflamed anti-American sentiments without even meaning to by patrolling on rooftops, right?
That's right.
What was the mistake they made?
Well, it was in fact what led up to the initial hostile demonstration whereupon Americans fired and killed Iraqis, which in turn set off Fallujah, if you will, a year ago last April. Iraqi cities are flat-roofed, and the Americans had taken over a primary school in the city. They had met no hostile resistance in the city at all. There had been no fighting there. And they moved out to Fallujah from Baghdad a couple of weeks after the fall of the city, merely to establish a presence there. They took over a school and then set, you know, snipers, ambush positions on the rooftops. The problem is that this gave them vantage points into neighboring courtyards of people's homes. And to this very traditional conservative society where women are generally kept in the house, in fact, their only real area of freedom, unrobed, where their faces are showing, are in the family courtyards. And so the men of the area believed that the Americans were spying on their women, which was a great dishonor to them, and very quickly inflamed the local sentiments, whereupon they sent a demonstration against a protest march against the soldiers. The Americans didn't react well. They fired into the crowd and killed 17.
My guest is John Lee Anderson. He covered the war in Iraq and its aftermath for The New Yorker. His new book is called The Fall of Baghdad. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with writer John Lee Anderson. His new book is The Fall of Baghdad. I'm interested in how educated Iraqis that you dealt with, many who had government jobs, fared in the post-war environment. Did you meet any of the government ministers who were your minders or spin artists after the fall of Hussein? I'm thinking in particular of Uday. I had trouble with the name. Atai, who was who was so strident in defending the government's position, even as American tanks were moving into Baghdad. Did you see any of these folks after the fall?
I did. I looked up a number of them. In fact, I went to see Uday Altaye, who I began to call Goebbels during the weeks we were locked into the Palestine Hotel with him during the bombing of Baghdad. He was the most odious and strident of martinets for the regime and began wearing a pistol and a uniform, and he was given to intoning stentoriously to the press and moralizing about the need to tell the truth and so on, and but stayed at his post until tanks were on the other side of the river from the Palestine Hotel, and only then did he disappear. 2 months later, I climbed the stairs of his apartment block and found him sitting on the 10th floor, no electricity, no elevator working, urine and garbage all over the stairs of this apartment building near the ministry he had once run, the information ministry now bombed out, and found him in his dishdasha robe with his wife and child and acridly defending his position, trying to reaffirm that he had always been a friend of the Western press, insisting that he had been secretly opposed to Saddam Hussein and wanting me to believe it was so now after all of the events that had occurred. And I let him speak for, it must have been more than an hour in this sort of monologue of his, rewriting history, as it were.
You know, I'm interested in his if his tone had changed. Was he the arrogant, strident defender he was, or was he friendly and charming and ingratiating himself with you?
Well, he was always a little bit schizophrenic. He could be friendly and charming one moment and terrifying the next, and arrogant. And he was warm and friendly, but as he began speaking, the old soapbox came out, and he was trying to insist that I knew him to be a man of compassion and humanity and so forth. In particular, he was very angry that the Americans intended to abolish his ministry. And this was before the insurgency had started. And he was referring to the Americans who'd arrived as short-sighted and stupid and so forth. And finally I said to him, you know, the Americans might be forgiven for not wanting you back at work. After all, you were arguably one of the men who were the public face of the regime. And in a country where mass graves are now being discovered, it's understandable if some people might associate you with that. I said it quite diplomatically. And he looked at me and he said, I was only doing my duty. I was never part of that. And it was interesting because what he said was what all of them said afterwards. There was an absolute refusal to accept any responsibility for anything or apologize for anything. And I think, in a way, it's the twin disaster of Iraq. On the one hand, the incredible lack of ability to engage with Iraqi society and the short-sightedness on the one hand of the American planners of the post-war, and on the other hand, a society that is so traumatized and twisted, really, that not one Iraqi to date has come forth in public and said they are sorry for anything that's ever happened there in the last 35 years. And, you know, the twain do not meet.
You know, I'm interested in also in people who weren't directly implicated in, you know, the brutality and crimes of the regime, but educated Iraqis who have skills which will be useful in building a new society, which, as I read your account, don't seem invested in it and seem alienated from it. I'm thinking of Dr. Walid, who was a physician who looks as if he may leave the country. What is it about the situation that is turning people like that who have education and skills away from a society that really needs them?
Fear. Dr. Walid is a prominent doctor at a clinic in Iraq, where just last week one of the surgeons was assassinated. There have been the professional class of Baghdad have been targeted by assailants since the Americans arrived, and as far as I'm aware, none of these crimes have been investigated or followed up. There's never been an arrest for the murder of, I think it's now over 24 doctors. The same is true in the universities, where prominent teachers and lecturers have been killed. To all intents and purposes, the intelligentsia of Iraq have been are being assassinated and are being driven out. Many tens of thousands have left. They're living in neighboring countries where their families and they can be safe, in Jordan, in the United Arab Emirates, in Syria, in other countries. Dr. Walid was still there as of midsummer. He was hanging on, but he was extremely worried about the situation, as he had been for the preceding months, and was exploring the possibility of leaving. There is, for a doctor, they simply don't have the funds to protect themselves. They don't have the money that Westerners do to hire security contractors with armored cars and automatic weapons at $1,000 a day, in order to do their jobs. It's fear. Whoever is behind the campaign of targeting Iraq's intelligentsia is doing it extremely well, and one suspects that it has a motive, and that is to break Iraqi society down to a common denominator that is more or less putty in the hands of the political movements trying to shape it.
What's going on there? I mean, is this the various militias who seek to control the country? I mean, don't they realize that they're going to govern, they're going to need, you know, people with education to run things?
They do. I spoke with a friend the other day, that an Iraqi who has a theory that it is in fact the Islamist extremists who are trying to kill the educated elite, who after all were mostly educated in the West and secular, whether Shia or Sunni. And so there is a logic behind this, and we've seen it in other totalitarian regimes that have seized power, in whether right or left, from Pol Pot's Kampuchea to Mengistu's Ethiopia and so on, where the intellectuals and the professional class are amongst the first to go onto the heap, the carcass heap, because then you have a population that you can mold at your will. It's a frightening theory, but there does seem to be something in it.
Maybe something like a Taliban regime in Iraq.
To all intents and purposes, I mean, when one would have to characterize the head chopping, bomb exploding jihadi extremists who have now made such a name for themselves in Iraq, one would have to equate them with something like the Taliban, only more sophisticated. It's quite frightening.
To what extent are foreigners who've come into Iraq responsible for this?
There were not foreigners, many jihadis in Iraq when the Americans arrived. They arrived during the war. I remember they stayed in our hotel, and I watched them leave the hotel Within 2 hours, 2 hours before the Americans actually arrived in the city, I watched about 60 young men from many countries who had come to participate in suicide operations against the Americans during the war just fade off into the city. And I'm sure many of them became part of the cells that soon began fighting and continue the American presence. The Americans have never really guarded Iraq's borders, thereby making it manna from heaven for any jihadi and Islamist who wants to come and kill Americans.
You're a journalist, not a policymaker, but the view you present is so lacking in hope. Should the Americans simply leave?
The Americans cannot leave. The Americans now have, quite apart from geostrategic interests, which dictate that America remain where it has invaded and make good of it, because the consequences now are of a vastly heartened Islamist extremist phenomena occurring as a result of Iraq. If America were to leave, it would be even further chaos. I don't pretend to have any solutions to the current situation, but America must make good. Less than 10% of the money earmarked for reconstruction in Iraq has actually been spent. By and large, most of it has been spent on security. There's very little the average Iraqi can point to that is positive about the American presence. And the Americans must find a way to make their presence in Iraq part of an international effort which is all about rebuilding Iraq and making life better for its people. It must prevail, or it will be the greatest failure in generations of foreign policy.
Well, John Lee Anderson, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Writer John Lee Anderson. His new book is The Fall of Baghdad. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a financial services company serving nearly 3 million members. Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, where values thrive. And by Alfred A. Knopf, publisher of The Love Wife by Gish Jen, author of Mona in the Promised Land. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how to dress like a bounty hunter. We meet Tom Evangelista, whose family bail bond business is the subject of a new HBO reality series, Family Bonds. Evangelista bails defendants out of jail, but if they run, it's his job to bring them in. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. There are two things about Tom Evangelista's life that make for some good television: a crazy job and a wacky family. And fortunately for HBO, they come in a package. Evangelista runs a family bail bond business in New York, and it's the subject of a new 10-part reality series which premiered this week. Camera crews from Stick Figure Productions followed Evangelista, his brassy blonde wife Flo, their three children, their oversized nephew Chris, and the rest of the gang around for months while they arrested fugitives and lived through family dramas. In the second episode, Evangelista's son Sal turns 18 and can't wait to join the business and start tracking criminals. I spoke to Tom Evangelista last week. Well, Tom Evangelista, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me.
Explain to us, if you will, what a bail bondsman does. I mean, how does he make or lose money?
I'm an insurance agent. That's pretty much what I am. I write through an insurance company, and when people don't have enough money to pay a cash bail, if a bail was $100,000 and they don't have that type of money, they would come to me, and they would put up probably a piece of property or a very large percentage of that in cash. And then we would take the risk and charge them a premium, just like your homeowners, your auto, or your health insurance. There's a mandated premium that's set by the state of New York. And then that's how I make a living from the commissions off of that bond.
And then while your defendant is out on bail awaiting trial, they're supposed to check in with you regularly. You're supposed to know where they are, right?
Well, the best way to put it is that I can't guarantee his presence unless I monitor his activities. We monitor their activities based on our guarantee or our affidavits that say that we promise to either bring them to court or to pay. So the only way I can guarantee that is if I know what his activities are, if I at least monitor his activities. And the activities being making sure he doesn't leave the state, he doesn't flee or make an attempt to flee, or someone has his bags packed. And the other hand, too, I mean, we don't bail people out to continue to commit crimes. We may very well do an inspection and find, a house full of drugs. If we do, he goes back and he loses whatever he has there in regards to drugs, depending on what jurisdiction we're in. We'll call NYPD and they'll come in and they'll take over that case. But, we bail people out so they could face the judge like a gentleman or a lady with their attorney and fight their case.
Now, if they disappear, you come get them, right?
Well, if they disappear, then that's when I go from wearing a suit to wearing some street clothes, and yes, I will pursue them, look for them, apprehend them, and bring them back, and bring them back to the judge.
When you're at work, when you're out apprehending someone, I would imagine that you probably want to give that defendant the immediate impression that it makes no sense for them to resist you or to flee. Now, the audience can't see you. Describe, if you will, what you look like and what you wear when you're out recovering a fugitive.
Well, I mean, my normal stuff that I would wear when I go out to apprehend a fugitive would be, probably a regular pair of street jeans, probably my sneakers or my boots. But we carry some self defense stuff in regards to OC spray, Aspartame, and always carries handcuffs, and shirts that identify who we are. And IDs, ID cards and badges who identify who we are. I'm not, as far as my personal appearance, I mean, I'm not a wrestler. I'm an average guy.
Well, you're muscular, and you bring a number of guys with you. So there's a pretty overpowering presence, I guess. I mean, not that you bully people, but... Right.
Well, that's the whole idea of it. I mean, I'm not going to go pick up one guy with two guys. I'm going to go there and pick him up with four guys because, the way that I look at it is this. The guy doesn't show up for court, that's a no-no. And now my job is to turn around and bring him back. So the indemnitor, whoever signed for him, does not have to pay. And in turn, I don't have to pay. But the most important thing is this. I treat everybody the same. If they want to be treated like gentlemen, they know that the somewhat jig is up, they're going back, they can either go back like gentlemen, and that's exactly the way I'll treat them, or they're going to go back and we'll make a stop for some medical attention and then they'll go back. But they're going back. I mean, that's it, plain and simple. Thank God, I mean, I'm doing this for over 10 years and I've never had to even give anybody a Band-Aid. So and I don't want to either. We don't want that kind of confrontation. I make it so I use my brain more than we do muscle. If that's probably the best time.
Right, and you also use your voice. I mean, now the way you said that to me, we can go back with a stop for some medical attention, or we can just go back. That communicated to me that you are not a guy I want to take it outside with. I mean, I'm wondering, did you develop a certain way of shaping your voice and your presence when you talk to defendants, or did that come naturally?
It came after I was stabbed once or twice and got the smacked out of me, excuse me, a couple of times. And then I realized that, you know, this is not getting anywhere being Mr. Nice Guy. And it's not that I'm not a nice guy, but when you push me on that side of the wire, okay, right now I'm in the middle. I'm between the courts and the defendant. And as long as we stay on that fine line, then we have no problems. I have no reason to come and see you. But if you push me onto that side, then it's almost like you would see, a metamorphosis change. I mean, I go from Mr. Nice Guy standing in the courtroom with a shirt and a tie to Tom's going to go get his money, because now it's a dollar sign. And I have to look at it that way. It's nothing personal. It's just business.
Have you been stabbed? Tell us about that.
I had a defendant that didn't show up for court. Well, actually, he did show up for court. I take that back. He was beating his wife up, and then he disappeared for about 4 or 5 days. We started to look for him. His next court date, I think he had about 2 or 3 days. But when he showed back up, he was a Hispanic gentleman, probably in his mid-40s, drunk out of his mind, shows up and I guess threatened that he was going to shoot everybody in the house, and he had a loaded gun in his pants, you know, tucked in his pants. But when I got there, he was listening to Spanish music and with a bottle of rum in his hand, and he was dancing around in circles. But every time the guy got his back to me, I wanted to come in. I'm looking through the window. I want to come into the door and try to get the guy, but I'm afraid he's going to turn around and get the gun and start shooting. So, I mean, I did probably the smartest thing. I just knocked. And when I knocked, he came to the door drunk, and I went, Jose, and he said, hola, and he lifted his hands up, and I took the gun out, and I pushed him in. And as I was putting cuffs on him, one of the people I was with wasn't watching my back, and his daughter, that's about 12 or 13 years old, stuck me in the ass with a metal nail file.
Wow.
So that was one of my battle scars. I got stuck in the right cheek, and I had to be taken to the hospital because it was so close to a major artery that was in the cheek of my butt that I covered it up with duct tape, but then the ambulance guy took me there with this thing sticking out of my butt.
So you didn't want to pull the nail file out yourself?
No, well, I couldn't. They told me not to do it when we called for the ambulance. They said, you know, and then when the guy looked at it, he said, you're lucky you didn't, because we don't know how close it is to the artery. I'd actually take an x-ray. But lo and behold, when I go in there, I find, this was in East Meadow in the hospital in Nassau County, and I have like 3 or 4 people that I know that I went to high school with that are in there, and they're all nurses. And, of course, I have this file sticking out of my butt. It wasn't one of my most, memorable moments.
Well, it was probably one of their most memorable moments.
It certainly was. I still hear about that.
Tell us about the other time you were stabbed.
Pretty much, I was looking for a guy, and he had I was searching a house. It was when I first started. I was with a new guy, and I was kind of new. But we were looking for a guy, and his brother was standing behind a door. And when I walked into the door, he just was standing on the side of the wall and pulled his arm out. The only thing that kind of saved me was my vest. I have, it went through the vest and it did cut my chest. I needed a couple of stitches, but if I didn't have a vest on, I probably would have got that shank right in my chest. I was looking for his brother. We were searching the house, and he thought the cops were there for him because he had a warrant. And I guess that's what he planned on doing to whoever came through the door, may it be me or a cop. So he wound up going to jail for that, and we ultimately wound up getting the brother.
Tell me what it felt like to have that shank coming through your vest and actually puncture it.
In the beginning, I wasn't, I felt it was the punch, like almost like someone punched me in the chest. It wasn't until after I smacked him in the head because, obviously when somebody does that, I'm going to retaliate. I smacked him in the head and got him on the ground. And these two guys weren't twins, but they look quite a bit alike. But now I have him on the ground face down with his hands behind his back, and I'm putting cuffs on him, and I realize that there's, this thing sticking out of my vest, and now I realize he got through, and it cut my chest. I needed a couple of stitches. It wasn't that bad. Thank God it hit the bone there,
My guest is Tom Evangelista. He runs a bail bond business in Queens, and he is the subject of a new HBO series called Family Bonds. We'll talk some more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with Tom Evangelista. He is a bail bondsman who works in Queens, and he has a family business which is profiled in a new HBO reality series called Family Bonds. Well, Tom Evangelista, I'd like to play our audience a clip from the show, and this is one of the crew that works with you on the apprehensions, Dan Bosworth, and he's describing, he's talking to your teenage son, Sal. He was a teenager when this was taped, working at a pizza shop, and he's describing a recovery that they'd gone through the night before. Let's listen.
What's going on, man?
You doing? What time did you come home last night?
Like 3 a.m. You missed an awesome recovery.
What happened?
Holy shit. We got to the house. Lady answers the door with a knife. And Chris is like, can you put that knife away? He says, we really need to come in and discuss something. We're here for so-and-so. So we go in, we search the whole house. Chris goes near the crib, pulls the laundry bag out, and there's the guy under the friggin' crib.
Took off and gone. He was hiding under a baby.
He hung under the baby's crib a little. And then all of a sudden, she starts flipping out, trying to jump on your father's back and claw him, and she's got claw marks on his neck. So I run up, I grab her around the waist, and I just held her up in the air by her waist. You missed a great one last night.
Well, once I turn 18, I'm never going to miss one, bro. I'll be there every day.
You got to come out.
I can't even come and stay in the van. I have to turn 18 before I can come out. Legally.
That was from the new HBO series, Family Bonds. The star is my guest, Tom Evangelista. It's a reality show which profiles Tom and his entire family, which runs a bail bond business in Queens. Now, Tom Evangelista, what we hear in that clip is Dan Bosworth is really juiced. He's excited by this kind of violent apprehension that occurred the night before. And your son, Sal, is even more excited. He can't wait to be a part of it. Now, they clearly get off on the intensity of finding a fugitive and bringing him back home. Do you?
Well, I could tell you that in the beginning of this business, when I was waiting for my bondsman's license, that's what I did. I did fugitive recovery. Back then, it took about a year to get a license, and that's how I made a living. I'm going to say that, in the beginning, of course, your adrenaline pumps up and you're all excited and you're looking for this guy for 3 weeks and all of a sudden, bing, you come across him. There he is. Yeah, it's exciting. It's like anything else. You accomplish something that crazy. Yeah, you get your adrenaline pumped up, excited. As far as my son goes, my son is a very unique kid. I mean, I couldn't ask for better kids. He's more excited about the apprehension of fugitives than he is about running or learning the bond business at that point in that stage of the film. But now he understands that, that's not how you make a living. I mean, we make a living by bonding people out of jail. The other part is actually, it's not cost effective. Sometimes it might take me 2 or 3 months on and off of looking for somebody, versus, the guy goes to court, and I don't have to waste all that time. That's more time that I have to go and help other people get out of jail. So it's not cost effective in essence for the business or in the bail bond business. Does he get excited? Yeah. Does he still get excited? Yeah. After he recovers, 1,500, 1,800, 2,000 fugitives, it's going to be second hat to him like anything else.
You're coming to work on a Tuesday. And you know that for the next couple of days, you have no apprehensions. You're going to be working the phones. You're going to be doing your business. Do you look forward to that Tuesday more or the Tuesday coming in when you know that night you're going to go out and get a dangerous suspect?
I would, again, I look more forward to that Tuesday that I know that I'm going to be in my office doing my bails, making my money, and leaving at a reasonable hour to go home with my wife and my kids. Yeah. I would prefer that any day of the week. Matter of fact, I would prefer never to have to chase a bad guy again.
We learn in this series that you're a 2-pack-a-day smoker, at least at the beginning of the series. Is this job stressful? I mean, I your wife seems pretty relaxed about it, but you're going into some tough neighborhoods looking for some bad actors. Does this eat at you?
Well, I mean, like anything else. I mean, I don't in the beginning. And if you you know if you watch the show, I mean, I don't take anything too serious until the time comes. It kind of get my mindset before I leave that, you know, what I'm looking for and who I'm looking for and what type of a person I'm looking for. Does that make me smoke? Yeah, of course. I mean, it's a stressful job. The bottom line is that, yeah, I smoke. And two packs, sometimes I get into my moods where I smoke one pack, sometimes more or less. Is it the job? I think it's a combination of my nutty family and the job. And as you can see, we're kind of unique. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And if we weren't, I don't think that Stick Figure would have approached us to do the show.
Right.
But, yeah, it's stressful, and I think it's more stressful knowing that some nut can be behind the door with a shotgun and waste me, and I'm not going to let my son or my nephew or my friend go walk in first. It's my guy, my obligation. I'm going in first. But I'll take those steps, and I'll take it as it comes, you know?
Well, that's just it. I mean, if you're going in first every time, how does your wife feel about that? How does Flo feel about that?
Well, I don't think that she likes it any more than anybody's wife would like it. But I've been doing it so long now, it's second hat. Maybe you get from doing it for so long, sometimes you get complacent and doing it. Like, it's like an everyday thing. Like, you wake up and people are creatures of habit. They wake up in the morning, they put on their shoes and socks and their underwear the same way every day. When we go in to look for a person, we have a system. I don't have to say anything to my people. They know exactly what to do. They know who's covering a door, who's covering a window, who's coming in with me, who's going up the stairs, who's going in the elevator. I mean, and it took a lot of time, effort, and training to get these guys to understand that. I don't really have to say much to them.
Okay.
I know when someone's going out the window. No one has to tell me. I can hear it. You know, I can know. I know if the guy's in there, who is it? And then all of a sudden it takes them 15 minutes to open the door. You know that this guy's jumping out the window or they're hiding them. As far as going through the door, every single time you go through that door, and if anybody tells you they're not scared, they're full of crap. Excuse me. No matter what, the minute you let the fear go away, then you become from professional to loony, I would think.
My guest is Tom Evangelista. He and his family are profiled in Family Bond. It's a new HBO reality series about their family bail bond business. We'll talk some more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Tom Evangelista. He and his family are profiled in a new HBO reality series called Family Bonds. Well, Tom Evangelista, you were approached by this production company to tape you and your family, not just while you're apprehending fugitives, but while you live your lives. Did you know your family was so entertaining?
I could say this. When we first started, when we first saw the first few episodes, it was like watching a home movie. So I'm going to have to say, yeah, I didn't think that they were entertaining, per se. I do know that some crazy stuff does go on in my house and my business with my family. Did I think that it would be an HBO series? No. I mean, a documentary? Yeah. One of the big things that I, in the beginning when Stick Figure approached me, was I was not interested in doing the standard bounty hunter show.
Well, this show isn't just about bounty hunting. It's about this wacky family that you got.
It's about my family. That's the reason why I did it. In the beginning, I said, no, I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to do a standard bounty hunter show.
Well, let me ask you this. Does it get it right? Does that look like the family that you know when you see these episodes?
What you see is what you get. That's us. I mean, we don't do anything different than we do if the cameras are there or not.
And
I mean, there's a lot of stuff that we do that these guys aren't there and they miss, and they get very upset because they miss it, but it happens.
Like what?
We had one night where Dan decided that he was going to try to he was going to try to wax Chris's hairy back, and he used a piece of duct tape. I mean, is that normal? No. Well, these guys, unfortunately, they weren't there to film it, but Chris let him do it. You know, I mean, I went and I bought I have a Rottweiler, and I'm trying to train him, and I bought one of these electrical, those electric collars. And when you give him commands, you know, if he doesn't listen, it rings, it makes a tone, and then after that, it has an electric pulse that jolts him to let him know that you're trying to, get his attention. And you could heighten that either up or down. Well, my son and my nephew decided that they thought it would be a good idea to try to see, what this feels like and who could take the most juice. And they have me pushing the button, which was fine with me because I wasn't doing it, But they're holding this thing like on their arm and they're saying, okay, I could do number three and pushing the button, and then I'm electrocuting them. And I'm saying to myself, I said, go call your mother. She's not going to believe that you two knuckleheads are letting me electrocute you at the table. So, this stuff does happen every day. I wouldn't use the word wacky. I would kind of say more unique than most.
Right.
Or nuts, and nuts maybe.
In episode two, we see your son Sal's 18th birthday party.
Yes.
Which gets a little out of control. Now, one of the characters is your nephew, Chris, who works with you, has on the bail bond business, and he is a big guy. What is it, 290 maybe? Bald head. I mean, he's an imposing fella. He has too many and gets into something with another friend at this party.
First, I'd like to thank you by saying he's 290. I think he appreciates that.
Oh, really? I'm selling him short? Are you at all embarrassed by, some of the stuff that, like that party, it gets pretty wild. I mean, we see, a lot of cake icing in people's faces and then kind of a nasty confrontation. Mm-hmm. Do you or are the rest of the family embarrassed at all by that?
No. And I'll tell you the reason why. The circumstances that surround any party that involve my nephew, always somewhere the end result is being drunk and starting an argument. I mean, that's just standard operating procedure at one of the evangelista parties. And, I'm kind of prepared for it, and I think everybody else is too. Am I embarrassed by it? No. Why should I be embarrassed by it? It's not that I went there and pulled my pants down. This is what happened. And if I pulled my pants down, I wouldn't be embarrassed either. But that's besides the point. No, I'm not embarrassed. I mean, this is my family. I'm never embarrassed about my family. One thing I could say is that regardless of what anybody sees on TV and regardless of what anybody thinks, these people are my family, and they would give their lives for each other. And that's kind of the concept, if you think about it. Every time that we go out, one is watching the other. One is willing to step up and risk their life for another. That's what family's all about. So we do play hard, but we work hard too.
Do you watch reality shows?
Yeah. Yeah, I watch some reality shows. Yeah.
Could you ever imagine yourself being in one? Is the experience what you thought it would be?
I tell you the truth, I'll be honest with you. So far, I'm kind of like left in the dark. I don't know anything about that end of the business as far as what's going to happen or what I'm going to see happen or what people are going to visualize. I never thought I would ever be doing a reality show.
Well, just what about the effect of having these guys with cameras follow you around all your life?
These guys are like my family now. Are you kidding me? These guys have been following me around going on 2 years now.
So you just forget about them?
Well, Matt, the co-producer is Matt Galkin. He's like my second wife. I must hear from him 13 times a day. What are you doing? Where are you? And I tell them, too, is this my first or my second wife? the camera guys, the sound guys, I mean, these guys, they sleep at my house. They eat at my house on Christmas Eve, Christmas Day. I mean, I know that reality TV is, here today, gone tomorrow, per se. It might last 2, 3, 5 years, 1 year, who knows? But whenever it does go until whenever it lasts, these guys are like, my family. I'm sure that it's not going to just stop there. These guys are, they're part of our lives now.
The other thing that's striking about at least a piece of your family is your wife Flo's conversations with her friends at the nail salon. which is pretty sexually explicit about you mm-hmm. and her. And I mean, mm-hmm. Howard Stern has nothing on this show. How do you feel about that stuff getting out there?
Well, let me tell you this. I'm going to say this, and I've discussed this issue a couple of times. I don't think that, if you notice in that one episode, she's discussing and talking with her sisters.
Right.
I mean, you know, they're sitting in their salon and they're getting their hair done and doing whatever, and they're talking about sex and about this and about that. I mean, if you think about it, what do we talk about when we're sitting around a bar having a couple of drinks?
Well, I don't think we do it with a camera running. That's the difference.
But the difference is that it just doesn't really matter. That's us. And
yeah.
She was discussing what she was discussing when she was discussing it. And if the camera was there, then the camera was there.
Well, what she discusses in part is you being one of the most sexually potent men on planet Earth. I mean, how do you feel about all of us knowing that?
I don't remember hearing that part.
Oh, you got to rewind the tape, Tom. You got to rewind the tape and listen to that part again.
I didn't hear that part about being potent. But, like I said, I work hard and I play hard too, you know. You know, when I'm home, I like to enjoy myself, and if it may be jumping on my bike and going for, you know, a week away with my wife or going away for a week with my wife and enjoying ourselves, that's what we do. If she discusses it with a friend, with her girlfriends or her sisters and her friends, and, you know, whatever she discusses, that's part of reality, I guess. That's what makes us, I guess, different than some of these other reality shows. Are we sometimes we go, oh my God, we shouldn't have said that? Yes. Are we embarrassed by it? No.
Well, Tom Evangelista, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It was a pleasure.
Tom Evangelista, his family bail bond business is the subject of a new HBO reality series called Family Bonds. It airs Sunday nights. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our researcher is Joan Westman. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Warner Home Video and the DVD release of 500 Nations, a documentary on America's Indian heritage hosted by Kevin Costner, available nationwide, and from Harcourt, publishers of Emma Donoghue's Life Mask, a love triangle set in London's high society of the late 18th century from the author of Slammerkin. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how early warnings of terrorism slipped through the cracks. We'll meet Richard Clark, who was the nation's top anti-terrorism official in both the Clinton and Bush administrations. Join us for the next Fresh Air.